It is impressive. Your waveforms are so much bigger than ours, Kevin.
Yeah, well, you know what they say about a big waveform.
I knew that was coming. Yeah. That was like, you just threw them the biggest softball.
It was so easy.
I wonder, though, why my level is so low. Look how babyish it is. It's so tiny.
You have a baby level. You have a cute little baby
It'll
level.
It'll grow with time. Just give it a...
Okay.
Kevin, do you kind of know how really stupid this podcast is?
All I know is that you guys are going to send me an Amazon gift card for being on the show, and that's why I'm here.
That's right. Okay.
$25.
That's exactly it. Well, Sweet. It's a really stupid podcast. We don't have guests that often, so it's really special. It's a big deal that
Never.
We've only once ever had both Jonathan and I interviewing someone before with Jason Fried, and so we don't totally even know how to do this.
Here's the thing, Kevin. We sing the intro in.
Okay.
So, Jason... I'm just talking to the editor right now. Jason, if you wouldn't mind. Actually, I found Jason through you, Kevin. Thanks a lot
cool.
for that.
Hi, Jason.
Hey, Jason. Jason, if you wouldn't mind letting this part in, and now when myself and Jake are going to sing the song, and then we're just going to do the podcast as disrespectfully as always, I think.
Let's hear the song.
Okay, let's do it.
Product Breakfast Club.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to the Product Breakfast Club.
Product Breakfast Club. I wasn't finished.
Oh, God.
Jake.
We're supposed to... Come on. And I'm your host, Jake Knapp.
You usually say where you are, dude.
In San Francisco.
Hey, this is Jonathan, and I am in Berlin.
And today, we're going to cut out all the rambling in the intro.
That's not true.
Because we have a very special guest. Our guest today is Kevin Rose. So Kevin is... Basically, he's a nice person. That's the only reason why he would be here, because he's a really big deal. Kevin founded Digg. He's founded a series of companies, Revision 3, Milk, which was acquired by Google. More recently, he's founded the apps Zero and Oak, and he's also an investor. He worked at Google Ventures when I was there. That's how I know him. He's currently a partner at True Ventures as well. He's done a bunch of angel investing, and the companies he's invested in, some that you might possibly have heard of, Twitter,
Never
Facebook,
heard.
Foursquare,
Never heard.
Medium,
Never
Nextdoor,
heard.
Blue Bottle Coffee,
no,
all kinds of things. And he is he's a media luminary. He was, anyway, we'll ask him more about that and Digg and how that's kind of exploded. But he has a podcast called The Kevin Rose Show, tremendously popular. Great guests on
Good
there.
Name like, as well.
Arya Stark from Game of Thrones was a guest recently on there. Tony Robbins, Ryan Holiday, the kind of folks that Kevin has on. He does a show called The Random Show with Tim Ferriss, and 1.5 million followers on Twitter. I don't even know why he's here. He may have left. He may have realized while I was talking.
I think
that
it's
this
charity.
Is a waste of his time.
It's pity.
Heyo.
Still
it's
here.
Pity.
I'm here.
You have to pretend not to be here until we say we're talking to you, you know?
Okay. I'm just enjoying the intro. Keep going.
Oh, by the way, Jason, obviously leave that in. That's the level we want to be at.
So, yeah, I know Kevin a little because we work together. And like when I found out I was going to be working with him, I was like, oh my God, this dude is a celebrity. One of the most striking things about Kevin is that he is a very nice guy, very down to earth. And so that's the only reasonable explanation for why he's on here with us today. But Kevin, we're just going to bombard you with some questions about stuff, and thank you for being on.
Yeah, dude. Jake, awesome to be reconnected with you. I was stoked to have you on my podcast, and that's going to be coming out soon, which I'm excited about talking about your book. So it's nice to be on your guys' show. Intro, wasn't a huge fan of singing, but outside of that, I feel like this is going to be good.
We worked on it for so long.
Yeah.
For most episodes, that's the highlight, but I think if we can get some nuggets of wisdom out of you, we might salvage this one. So first of all, we have a lot of folks who are building products. We have a lot of designers, a lot of people who are, you know, maybe they're early in their career, but also some folks who are like further on in their career, they're in companies or they're in startups building stuff. So I feel like we want to selfishly for them get as much product knowledge out of you as possible. And selfishly for us, like as much about marketing and telling stories as possible. When you built Digg, it was 2004, right?
That's right. Yeah, it was the tail end of 2004 was when I launched that.
So, and then like fast forward to today, you're building Oak right now, which is like really taking off. This is a meditation app. And what's different now building a product from 2004?
Oh, man. So much. I mean, it's crazy that it's been that long. I can't believe it was 2004. I mean, the entire tech stack for how you build products has completely changed. One, there was no mobile back then.
Does that make it easier or harder?
So there are a couple things. One, it was easier in terms of you just had to worry about one platform. It was just the web, right? That was all you had to worry about. The software, though, was definitely harder in terms of you had to set up your own servers. There was, you know, we had the whole LAMP stack was Linux, Apache, MySQL, and PHP. And so that's what everything was running on. You know, I went down and purchased servers, took them down to my local colocation facility, racked them, brought them online, configured the software. I had a buddy of mine that was also a Linux administrator. So he helped me come in and kind of configure Apache and a bunch of the other stuff. And it wasn't just like standing up instances like you can today with like two clicks. So a lot more manual configuration, but you know, that got better over time. And obviously AWS came on the scene and just made things a hell of a lot easier to get things off the ground. But then came mobile. And so that's like yet another skill set that you need to hire for and develop against. And yeah, so I think things are easier in some regards and harder in others.
How different is it for you today with all the products that you've been involved in, either building them yourself or advising people who are building products, in terms of like figuring out like what to build, what to do? Like, is it still feel like a quest, or does it feel like now you're just like, I know exactly how to handle this or that?
Well, I think there's certainly every product is so unique that they come with their own set of challenges. And so just really understanding the data and making sure that you've properly instrumented everything so you can really truly see what's going on behind the scenes, I think is important. So, you know, no two apps are alike in that regard. And I think that when I meet with entrepreneurs and talk through their product plans or what they're working on, there's still a lot that I'm learning. So I don't feel like I have this figured out by any sense, but I think that it's gotten a lot more crowded. So I think it's harder for people to stand out from the crowd these days. If you take any popular kind of like vertical, whether it be like a meditation app or a health and fitness related app, or you name it, there are dozens, if not hundreds of competitors for the most popular kind of segments to go after. So I think in terms of, if you look at back at kind of Web 2.0, when it first got started in 2004, 2005, there were a lot fewer of us building products. And so now with the, you know, advent of the App Store, making it easier for people to learn how to write code, there's just a lot more people doing it.
I have my own sort of theory about this, but it's probably overly simplistic. But before I reveal my overly simplistic idea, what do you think has worked for you over the years that's made you continually, it seems like you've continually been successful in a lot of different avenues. Do you know what works?
Yeah.
What's special about Kevin?
Well, I've certainly had a lot of failures. I think one of the first and foremost thing is I've always considered failure as just a way to learn. It's really just admitting that you've learned something. So if you can approach it with that attitude and that mindset, then you don't mind it. It doesn't like weigh you down in any way. Like when something fails for me, I shut it down, but I'm like, huh, okay. Like, what did we learn? What's the postmortem on this? Like, what can I carry forward with me into my next product? And so I know a lot of entrepreneurs that have gone out and tried things and product people that have tried things where they really internalize a lot of the stuff and beat themselves up when something doesn't go well. I think that's a shame. That's just outside pressure from other folks or just really fearing what other people think of you.
Okay, wait, I want to interrupt you for a second because that moment of the thing failing, I feel like that is something I often hear people talking about how, as you said just now, failure is so important to success. But I have to say that like, while I believe that in the abstract or even like, I believe the philosophy of it, but in my experience, when it happens to me, I stop being able to sort of step away from it and it does become personal. And like, even if people are outwardly saying like, yeah, it went okay, if I feel like it failed, like it's really, it feels crappy. Like, does it really not feel crappy to you?
It doesn't.
It doesn't. Interesting.
The thing is, if you think about, there's a very high likelihood that you're going to die of cancer or cardiovascular disease.
And thanks, Kevin.
Oh, nice one. Nice one, Kevin.
No, right. No, no, yeah.
I'm not saying, a breakfast club.
Yeah, exactly. Bring the cheer back into it. What are you afraid of? Like, when I die, I hope people look back over my career and just look at it as a whole and say, he tried a bunch of crazy shit. I don't even care if, like, the majority of it is successful or not. I just want to be known as someone that pushed and tried different things. Like, I had this app called Tiny.
Yeah.
That was a way to share these little, small, miniature videos. Oh, thank you. It was a fun experiment, and it absolutely took off faster than Dig or anything else I had ever built. It blew up over the course of a couple weeks.
Just in case people haven't seen it, it was like you would open the app and you'd have this grid of videos that people had shared.
It's like 12 videos you could see on the screen at once. It was like a grid.
And so they're small. They're tiny. Each one's tiny. And they looped.
And there was no audio. You could just go in and create these fun little miniature looping videos. And it was a way to like share just like fun little moments in life throughout your day and not feel the weight of does this video or photo need to represent me in the best possible light. Because they were so tiny, you didn't care how you looked. There's videos of people in the shower. Like it was just all kinds of craziness that was happening in the network. But it was fun. It was a fun product. And I like that we tried that. Now it failed. It went down in flames and burned up and no one was using it like 3 weeks later. But I love that we were able to try something that no one had tried before. And we were really pushing the GPU inside of the iPhone. We had to optimize a bunch of code and rewrite it like several times because at the time the iPhones couldn't display, there's either 9 or 12 videos all at the same time running and looping. Even though where they were small, they had to have all these instances of this video player going back and so it would crash a lot. And so we had to write our own playback mechanism and scheme for that. So that to me is so much fun, is like trying these things. And I felt that way with Dig too when we were doing some of the live kind of visualizations of people digging different objects in real time. And you would see in Flash, we were using Flash back in the day, you would see like these like swarms of people collecting and gathering around information, like these articles, and they would like the bubbles would grow bigger on the screen. And I was like, wow, we're looking at all this in real time and no one has done this before. And it was just, that's the thrill that I love about building products. And so I know when you're trying these crazy things, like, you know, most of the times it's not going to work out, but that's why I'm in the game to begin with, is just to have fun and try this stuff.
The emotional investment, like how do you frame it for yourself so that when you go in to building Tiny, for example, because you do have to be emotionally invested so that you, I imagine, so you give it like your full throttle, like you're passionately thinking about it, caring about it. When you see it fail, it's like, how do you stay emotionally like buoyant when it fails?
Yeah. I mean, I think that I wouldn't be human if I didn't feel something when it doesn't go the way you want it to go. I think that there is that moment when you're like, huh, okay, yeah, this isn't going to work. Like there's that aha moment, because your initial thinking, and I think it's the right approach, is you launch a product and you want to give it its proper shot. And that might mean doing a handful of product iterations over the course of 3 months, 6 months, whatever it may be. But then there is that moment in time where you say like, okay, am I just like continuing to do this and continue to iterate because I'm like emotionally invested in it? Or is it really the best thing just to shut it down and move on to the next thing? And there does come a time where you say, okay, this isn't going to work and let's go ahead and close it down. And I think in my mind at that point, the first thing I'm focused on at that point is really damage control with my staff and the people that have worked on the product, because I know not everyone is like me, and people that have put a lot of time and energy into writing the code behind this thing and doing a lot harder work than what I do, which is just really kind of like, you know, working on wireframes and working with designers to spec out the functionality of it. I focus on them. But for me, like the way that I'm able to compartmentalize these things in my brain is that I look at projects like any meaningful work, like done in like 3 to 5 year chunks. And so I think about, I'm going to go off and try something new every 3 to 5 years until I find something that I'm willing to double or kind of triple down on and spend a longer chunk of time. So I just see it as a natural cycle. Like it's just something that's going to happen. And yeah, it's a bummer, but there's always something that I walk away with when I kind of do this postmortem where you write down all of the things that went well, things that didn't work out, things that were surprises. And there's always something that I think that you can take away from a project, you know, whether it be the types of people that you hired, how you managed a certain situation, your launch strategy around a certain product, where people were falling off the product, like little things that you just like naturally know to roll into your next thing.
Right. Okay. What's the most recent time that you did a postmortem on something? What's the most recent thing that you learned in that category? Like it's the thing that was surprising to you after you've been doing this for a while. What's something recently that surprised you?
Yeah, I think that one of the things I've realized is that sometimes you can be too early. And there has been a handful of times where I've worked on products where you build something, it has a little bit of traction, but it actually just, rather than shut it down, if you could just set it aside.
Oh, yeah.
And do maintenance on it versus like new product iterations and just give it its own natural time to kind of grow. That has worked out a couple times for me. Like I have a fasting app called Zero. This idea of doing intermittent fasting, which is starting to gain some serious momentum now. But, you know, we launched it as a basic little fasting timer. And the kind of thesis behind it was like, okay, well, I believe a couple of things to be true. One, there will be continue to be studies that are published that show the benefits of fasting, both in terms of longevity, but in glucose control and weight control and a whole slew of benefits that will come out of that. And if that's the case, there are going to be more people that want to do this and have a support network and a way to do it in a structured way so they can understand, you know, some of the potential downfalls or risks around it and just the proper ways to do this type of thing. So, you know, we launched this app a couple of years ago. It really kind of was just not doing a whole lot, just like a 100 downloads a day kind of thing for the first, you know, 6 months or so. But I believed in the kind of like future of this idea that those things would be true. And so I just put it on maintenance mode and just didn't really touch it and just did a couple little bug fixes here or there and just let it kind of slowly build. And, you know, now today we're in the top 75 in health and fitness, and we're doing 4,000 plus downloads a day, and I've had probably 15 or so million fasts done. And so it's really starting to ramp up and grow. And I just hired a CEO to kind of go and run that side of the business because there's a lot of benefit to kind of like figuring out how to do fasts with like-minded people and then also connecting potential physicians with fasters. And like, there's a lot of things that we want to do on the product side. But the lesson there was just like, if you think you're early, just sit on it, especially given that today's costs, like to run something like that is next to nothing on, we're using all Firebase functionality for all the back end there. You're talking like, you know, $100 a month to run the whole thing, even though, you know, hundreds of thousands of people are using it, which is crazy. So yeah, I think I'm more like, let's build something great, get it out there, and then just sit back and give it time to breathe and kind of like create its own natural following. Versus before, I was very much about like, okay, if something doesn't work in the first 2 months, like, let's just kill it, you know?
Yeah. Oh, this is so good. Okay. I'm like frantically scribbling notes over here because I'm thinking about how to apply this to the things that I'm working on as well. John, I totally have locked you out.
Oh man, I'm loving that. I mean, I think it's actually also great for me. You know, for any listeners, there's a lot of young listeners, a lot of young product designers listening to the Product Breakfast Club. And for you guys to just know, I'm sitting here, you know, speaking to Jake Knapp and Kevin Rose, and I'm just like, this is just so cool. I'm happy to sit here silently for the next 3 hours. But I got a question for you, Kevin.
Shoot.
So I think that a huge topic in the product world, and especially just hearing what you spoke about there with Tiny and also with Oak and also with Zero, a huge topic is when you're building a product, how much of what you're doing is based on gut feeling? How much of the feature selection that you have in the first version is based on gut feeling? And how much is it really based on sort of like deep market research? Because for me, I feel like a lot of companies in Silicon Valley, especially a lot of corporates as well, they are sometimes worried about the use of gut feeling. But I just would love to know, if you look at something like Tiny, like how did that start? Did you do a lot of market research? Did you do a lot of user research? Or did it just sort of like appear in your mind? How did that happen?
It's a good question. I'm trying to think about the origins behind Tiny. I think what had happened is I saw the grid of Instagram photos on the profile screen. When you go to your profile and you see the little tiny squares.
Yeah.
And I'm like thinking to myself, like, how cool would it be if those were just like moving and doing all kinds of little crazy things, almost like the Brady Bunch back in the day, like the little segmented like little windows. And so it was just kind of that gut around there. And I was talking to another product designer friend of mine, Danny Trin, about it. And we were like trying to figure out who was going to build it because I wanted to see it exist. And so we really went out and said, let's just see what this feels like. And let's do it in a down and dirty kind of way. And in terms of like not really overthinking it, but just getting a prototype in people's hands as soon as possible. You know, that allowed us to go off and build this in kind of a month and a half, 2 months versus it turning it into some big, long, drawn out thing. And I would say that I'm in the camp that you can do user testing and use it for a couple things. One are users are really good at coming in and identifying gotchas, like these big aha, like, oh shit, like we should have named the button that or called it this or made this more prominent or this less prominent. Like I find that when you could collectively get a big group of people to use something and provide feedback, not in terms of groupthink feedback, not together as like a focus group, because I think that's horrible. But if you get them to provide independent feedback back to you, you will see trends emerge that jump out as like, oh, we forgot to address this, or we should do a little more of an in-depth explainer here, or get users to this screen faster, whatever it may be. And that's really valuable stuff. But that said, I think that when you have a truly unique, novel idea that has never been done before, it is next to impossible to explain it to people or to do market research on something like that, just because people have never used it before. It's like a great example is when I had the idea for Dig, this idea of like pulling together and voting on social news and using that to kind of get promoted to the front page, the best stuff. We were a year before Reddit. We were the first ones to do this. And so when I explained it to a handful of friends and kind of showed them my rough mock-up and asked them if I should spend more time on it, I didn't get any validation. Like everybody was like, I don't understand why you would create this. My girlfriend at the time was mad that I was spending my savings on it because she thought I should be using that for a down payment for a house. And
which you should have been, actually.
Definitely.
I probably should have been.
Think about if that appreciated that.
Exactly.
The resale value.
Yeah, that actually might have worked out better. But, you know, I think that I really caution entrepreneurs when they are really passionate about an idea, even if I can't see it, I always tell them not to take our feedback too seriously, because oftentimes a lot of it is in, especially when they don't actually have a product yet, but it's just like a back of a napkin idea. A lot of the beauty of their idea is locked up in their mind. And it's very hard to use language to convey some of the nuance that goes into an idea that makes it cool and exciting. And so I've had entrepreneurs pitch me or random people just like see me at a bar and say like, hey, I got this idea. Can I run it by you? And if they don't see me getting excited about it, like I've had young founders be like kind of bummed out by that. And I'm like, no, go build this. I'm the one that turned down Pinterest in its first round. Like I sat down with them and said like, I just don't get it. And we're all going to be wrong from time to time, and that's okay. But if you're really passionate about this, like don't let any investor or anyone else persuade you from pursuing that.
I think it's really interesting to hear that, you know, someone comes into a bar, shows, it talks to you about an idea, and, you know, they shouldn't be disappointed about if your reaction is not great to it. And I think that it comes down to also the fact that ideas are sometimes just not as interesting as how they're executed. And I have a feeling that there's also this somehow in this tech industry, sometimes like really exciting ideas get a lot more press, but it's actually the like really well executed things that are often the most successful. For me, the Apple AirPods or, you know, this one Peloton bike in your house. I wouldn't consider these to be the most exciting things on the planet if you had a headline and like on paper. But when you see these products, when you use these products, they just kind of blow you away. And I think it's really difficult to just on a napkin and almost just like purely from the idea point of view, like get people excited about those things.
I agree 100%. That's why I'm always of the mindset that the best way to pitch someone, especially investors, is even if you're creating a deck and it is mostly based on an idea, if you could have some type of visual representation of that, whether even if it's a non-working prototype that I can just tap through, I think that's the better way to do it.
I'm not going to rat hole on design sprints, but you're giving us a great like sales pitch for it, which is
totally
like
by sprint,
making the thing real. Just like going in with whatever your hunch is and making that thing real gets you so much farther than researching it to death. And I think just to put like a tie a ribbon around it for listeners who are facing this debate, because this always comes up inside companies of all sizes, teams of all sizes, how much market research and sort of validation, how much do we need people to tell us this is a good idea before we do it? How much evidence do we need before we actually act? Like it's, you have to act. And if you talk to people like Kevin, who actually have built things that are successful, hear stories of people having an idea that maybe sound a little nuts and they actually did it. And then when you do it, you find out sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't. But I don't think you find super successful products where they have researched their way to this sort of conclusion about what the opportunity is. It comes from an insight, right? Like a special insight.
Yeah, 100%. And it's funny when you sit down, and the one benefit of being in the Bay Area is that you get to kind of just meet and bump into people doing really interesting things. And one of the things I've certainly noticed, and I'm sure you've probably, many people listening have read about it in various books and things like that, but when you see someone like a Stuart Butterfield create this game and say, the game's beautiful, it was visually stunning, Daniel Burke, our mutual friend, was working on it, but it didn't work out. And he's like, you know what? I kind of like the way we've been using IRC to like communicate. Like, let's create this thing, call it Slack, and focus and pivot to that and build that. It's entrepreneurs trying something, saying like, that didn't feel right. Let's just go on to my next gut hunch. Like the same thing happened. I remember in the early days, I was invited into using Bourbon, which was Kevin Systrom's first startup before he did Instagram. And it was like kind of like this Foursquare type check-in like thing. And it just didn't really work. And he's like, well, let's go and try and apply some beautiful filters to photos and throw it in a feed. And we started using that. It was like, wow, like this is cool. It's way lighter and less weight than saying doing something on Facebook. And you kind of follow your gut. So many times I've seen the biggest multi-billion dollar companies, they've never come out of market research. I've never seen one example, maybe at like Salesforce or something, but like I've never seen like one example of an entrepreneur being like, you know what, that damn focus group, it led to this great product. It's always like some type of like internal intuition around like, this might work. What the hell? Let's go give it a shot.
And so you still think VR is amazing?
I've never said VR was amazing. And thankfully, I did a Medium post calling it out and saying it was horrible several years ago.
Are you still thinking it's not going to become mainstream and not become like a billion-dollar business?
I mean, here's the deal with VR. It demos so well.
Oh, yeah.
Like you put a headset on and you go into this world and you're twisting around planets or dodging laser beams. But then what happens is about 20 minutes later, your like forehead starts getting all sweaty. And it's just like, you're just like,
start feeling sick.
Well, and you've got like just a lot of equipment on you. And it's just like heavy and cumbersome. And I think we're getting to a lot better place, because if you look at VR just even like 3 years ago, you had to wall mount all these different units. And I think of these things in terms of the way that any technology really takes off is when you're competing against something else. So in this case with VR and VR gaming, you're competing against desktop gaming or more so like PS4s and Xboxes and things like that. And when you think about, okay, what is the benefit I'm receiving from this new device? And yes, it's a different way to look at the world. It's immersive and it has those pluses. But I feel that it has to be a true like order of magnitude leap in upside in order for anyone to really the masses to adopt it, right? The great example I have with this, I've always with VR, is kind of reminds me of 3D TV. So if you remember 3D TV back in the day, we got these like goggles and you know, you have them for your house and they took these little watch batteries and you put them in and all the TVs were equipped with them and you're like, yeah, like let's all get together and do 3D TV. And you do it one time and you're like, oh, that was pretty cool. And then one of them runs out of like batteries. They're like, oh, where's the battery? And like, well, let's just put it in the drawer. And then it's in the drawer and then you just kind of like don't remember. And then obviously 5 years later, you throw them all out and you're done with it. And I think that the ease of use has still been fairly difficult. The setup time has been difficult. The requirements from a PC have been pretty substantial. There's just a lot of barriers to getting to that true kind of 10x improvement. So I'm not saying it'll never happen, but I just think that all these people that thought was going to happen within a couple of years are just insane.
I was excited.
Were you on the VR bandwagon?
Yeah. I bought the HTC Vive. I also bought the Oculus Rift and the Oculus Go, and also the Samsung VR headset, because I was just super excited about trying it all out. But exactly like you said, I mean, to be honest, it's exactly like that. I tried it out a few times and then it was like, I kind of took it down and then I was like, I'm probably never going to build that up again. And I haven't used it in about 2 years. I also bought the HoloLens. I was really interested to see how all of this, you know, AR, MR stuff would work out. And yeah, I mean, I guess it doesn't matter if there's a really, really cool technology. It only matters if it's actually something that you find interesting or if it's a utility. So,
and it really has to hit that mark where a user says, this is so much better than the existing thing that I'm going to go through the trouble to make the change.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just like if I were to come out with a version of Instagram today that had five more filters and maybe a slightly better way of like sharing a story, no one would move to it. Not a single person. It doesn't matter if the product's better. There's a switching cost involved, right?
Yes.
When it comes to followers and everything else. And that applies to video gaming as well. Like there's a switching cost and the titles aren't there. And there's just too many things against it, at least right now. I'm hoping when these things get ultra lightweight and they're easy to just like throw on and off and they're untethered from the PC and you get even more power built into the units, like hoping something will emerge there. But I still think we're another like 5, 7, 10 years out before something like that has the potential to take off.
Especially since, I mean, Jake, you just got a Nintendo Switch as well. Kevin, you have a Nintendo Switch. I think it's almost...
Why are we doing this podcast?
Yeah, I know. Why the hell aren't I...
Right now.
Kevin destroyed me in Mario Kart last time.
It's true.
It was quite embarrassing.
Who's your go-to character on Mario Kart, Kevin?
Gosh, that's a good question.
Come on, man. Baby Toad.
I don't know. Jonathan's pretty easy to beat with pretty much anyone, so I'm not sure. Dealer's choice. Like I would take pretty much anyone. I would say Yoshi's probably my favorite, though.
Yoshi's good. I like Wario, actually.
He's cool.
He's that good, but just the comments from Wario are so good.
That's what we should talk about.
Since I've derailed the conversation with that question, I want to ask or like make sort of a meta point / question. This gets back to me saying I have a theory about what one of your superpowers is, Kevin, which is while you understand such depth, the business and what's possible with technology, all this stuff, like building products, all these things. The secret superpower, I feel like, is how you translate those ideas, those insights, whatever you're thinking, into the human world. You speak in a way that's interesting to listen to. People have been listening to the podcast so far. Well, you've just talked about VR. There's a lot of really boring ways to talk about the VR market. Like, you get right to the point. Like, look, your forehead gets sweaty. Like, putting stuff into human language and understanding how to tell the story of things. I remember being in like a Google Ventures meeting and everybody's going around and kind of talking about their updates. And I'm not going to like throw people under the bus and say that our colleagues there weren't interesting. They were totally interesting people, but the content sometimes of what you're talking about at a venture fund could be pretty dry. Like there's a lot of like terms and blah, blah, blah. And like, I remember you'd talk and it would just be like, oh, whatever Kevin's talking about, even if I have no idea about the product, I'm going to like understand what's going on. It's going to make sense to me. I'm going to get it. And it seems like from an outside observer that that's a big part of what's made so much success come from when you're sharing things or even from your products. I feel like you tell the story of them well. And I was just curious if like, is that something that you consciously fostered? Do you feel like it's like a something you really intentionally have to work at or what? Where does that come from?
Well, I appreciate you saying that. First of all, I try to think about, especially when I think about on the investment side, putting money into a new company, I always try and kind of like close my eyes and say, how might this play out over the next 5 years? And try and see it through the entrepreneur's eyes and say, okay, if everything goes to plan, it will create this type of business or this type of outcome. I don't mean outcome in terms of financial dollars, but in terms of impact on the world and uptake and usage. So I'm always thinking like, what is the average consumer think of this? How is it going to impact them? Will my mom ever use this product? You know, like there's a bunch of little questions around that that I try and make sure that I give enough cycles in my brain to consider. You know, I thought about that in the early days of Twitter. I remember, so this is going to sound crazy because it is the norm these days, but this is when Twitter first came out. I signed up and they introduced this idea of following someone without it having to be a bi-directional relationship. And so if you take a look at MySpace, at Friendster, at all the other kind of social platforms before this, it was always, oh, I know this person, friend me, I accept your friendship, friend back, mutual friendship complete, right? That was like the mechanism for friendship online. And then Twitter for the first time said, guess what? You don't have to know this person. They don't have to know you. You can just say, I respect what they have to say. I'm interested in what they have to say. Follow this person. And I was like, whoa, wait a second now. Like, this is cool. If this catches on, this could be massive because you're giving celebrities and tastemakers and all these people that have opinions and instantly have their own email newsletter. They have a way to blast out to the masses an idea, a thought, something like that. And I'm like, I could see people signing up for this service because it was just us geeks that were using it initially, you know? And I remember being at South by Southwest and I tweet like, hey, I'm going to be at so-and-so bar. And it was like status updates at that point. I don't know if you guys remember those days, but
you'd tell
people where you were going to be
and
hope that just more people would show up, you know, and hang out with you. But I just like closing your eyes and like imagining what that could become. And that was like, okay, this is something I want to back and invest in. But I try to break it down. Every product that I look at, I try to put it through that type of lens. Is that kind of answering your question?
Yeah,
or no?
I think so. Yeah, no, it is. It is. But I mean, I guess like I'm wondering where that comes from, because I remember seeing Twitter when it, I probably didn't see it as early as you did, but I remember seeing it when it more or less first came out. And like, you and I are roughly the same age. Like, it's not like you had more life experience than I did. Like, you just get stuff better than I did. So like, I remember seeing it and thinking, oh, this is like in chat when I can set my status. Mm-hmm. And it's just like that with like a history and I can see other people's. And like, that was just like my mental. And I was like, I guess that's cool. And like, people who I know who are cool are using it. So I guess I'll sign up and use it. You know, I was trying to like put on my investigative journalist hat and try to think like, where does this come from for Kevin? And you've mentioned in your podcast that you struggled in school as a kid.
Mm-hmm.
And one of my hypotheses was, and you can tell me what you think of it, like, do you think you developed strategies when in school for turning that around or whatever that you're applying when you're like really intentionally analyzing things and you sort of built a muscle there? Because there's a strength there that, you know, it's very uncommon for taking what's going on in the world and then synthesizing it into like the human likely thing to happen. And it's, do you think there's anything to that?
Maybe. I think that I certainly had a lot of issues in school. Issues with being able to memorize things. I was horrible at memorizing things, so I did poorly on tests. Thankfully, I went to switch schools and was able to go to a class that offered a computer class. That was the first thing I really loved. I just knew it was a passion from the second I started like messing around and learning different commands and things like that. I just, for some reason, that was a lot more natural to me. I've just always been a daydreamer. My wife will like snap her fingers and kept giving your attention. I was always one of these kids that would just draw and just daydream and just think about things, like just make up things in my mind. When it came to computers and technology, I was like, okay, what could I invent? Like, I was so inspired by Bill Gates, like when I was younger, before Steve Jobs made his comeback. And Gates like just created the software company that was making such like cool software, and I was able to connect and get online. And I just like was like, wow, you can just think of anything and then just go build it. Like, that's kind of amazing that we can do that. I just daydreamed about like, what should exist? What should we use? And I still do that today. Like, I always think about like, what things should exist in the world? Like, is there certain pain points that we're having, or is there certain things that could be more efficient, or just always thinking about mostly horrible ideas, like just things that are just silly and dumb. But
yeah.
I love that exercise. And I do think it is an exercise where if you can force yourself to be a little silly and to come up with a new idea or two per day, 99% of it's going to be just garbage that you throw away. But I do think there is something to what you're saying in that it is a type of exercise that hopefully you can strengthen over time. I'm not sure if that's the case, but yeah, for me, it's always just been daydreaming where my best stuff comes out of.
I think that's fascinating, because I think of daydreaming as something that like, you're right in that sense of like your wife like snapping your fingers, like it's something we're discouraged in many cases from doing, mm-hmm. right? Like, and it sounds like almost when you see Twitter for the first time, or when Bourbon switches to Instagram, it's that daydream quality. You kind of allow you to say, okay, I'm going to kind of like go into this mode where I am going to imagine the future of that. Like, what could happen, and letting that kind of grow. And if that's practiced well enough, maybe that's sort of the seed of it. I mean, obviously there's a ton of other things. I don't want to try to simplify down your success to some like little trick that people can apply, but you know, maybe daydreaming a bit more might be something that I'll take away.
Honestly, that's one of the things that I'm grateful that I was never put on any ADHD medicine. And I know that I'm putting my hand into a hornet's nest here by just saying this type of stuff, because it's a very controversial thing amongst parents and their kids that have these at times debilitating issues. But I'll give you a great example. Like, my niece, and my sister would be fine with me saying this, but she suffers from ADHD to the point where if she's not on meds, like she's just like cannot even focus to do any type of work at school. Like, it's pretty hardcore. And I was having this conversation with her a couple of weeks ago, and I was like, you know, I wonder, and this is like my own just like curiosity, I wonder if that's not doing more potential damage. And I was talking to her about this. I said, okay, if you take her off the meds, her grades go down to D's and F's, and she's not going to get into a great school. Is that stifling some potential creativity that would come out of that brain in its crazy ADHD state where you're all over the place and you're just like, I don't know. For me, I feel like I have ADHD, and I feel like it's kind of a blessing in a way, in that it allows me to dream up crazy ideas or consider crazy realities. And if I was being medicated for that, I wouldn't have done any of these fun things that failed.
Well, totally. I mean, maybe that's the root of why I'm so interested in this particular part of it, because as a parent, and my oldest son is 15 and I have a 7-year-old, and there are all of these standard default things that the school or that the prevailing culture will expect of your children, you know, and of like these paths that we're supposed to take and be on. And as a parent, you're like, God, if anybody's going to stand up for what is truly special about my son, it has to be me. Otherwise, the culture will just take it and run. And it's like you said, it is putting the hand into the hornet's nest, because I won't claim to be an expert about these things. But I do know that when you're a parent, you're trying to figure out how to do best by your kids and give them the best possible chance to have the most unique parts of them be expressed as adults. And for the love of learning and the thing that, you know, like the fire you felt when you started computer class and like started doing that stuff and it felt right and clicked. Like, you don't want a kid to get to the point where they're dead to being excited about those things and they can't be anymore. You want to keep it those unique, like weird things that kind of break the system, that are abnormal, that are what can make a life so special and so wonderful later on. And so, yeah, anyway, I don't have a conclusion to that, but like, I think it's really important. And if you have a thing in yourself that you feel like you're repressing because it doesn't fit into the culture, you got to try to find a way to bring
that.
It back out. And if you're a parent, or if you're at a transitional point where you're a student or something, you can't shut those voices down. I mean, unless they're actually voices that are sort of scaring you or something. But
it's like, also like, I mean, I was in college and school a lot more recently than you two guys. Then you two old men. And for me, it was a disaster. I mean, I couldn't concentrate on anything. I was just interested in doing, you know, learning how to do animation on my computer, doing comic books, making short films, like completely distracted all the time, really not doing well at school at all. Like Kevin, what you said there, I say that to my friends all the time. I'm like, imagine if I'd grown up in an era where we would have been medicated for kind of acting like I do still today. I mean, honestly, I think the only reason I get anything done is because my company is so expensive to run right now. And if it wasn't, I probably wouldn't get stuff done. You know, I have to almost like build these things around me to make sure things get executed, because I'm just like the world's most all over the place person.
Yeah, Jake and I were going to talk to you about that, actually. We think you should.
Hey, listen.
I think you should go on a little something.
I think I should. I was actually going to crack open a whiskey. What I wanted to do is I wanted to end this podcast with a couple of quick questions, like a, what's it called, quick fire round. And maybe since I'm the baby here, I can ask both of you, because I'd like to hear some of your answers as well. Also, Kevin, just so that you're not here for like 7 hours, I'm sure you have plenty of things to do. So I'm going to ask some dirty questions, and the first one's to Kevin. What are your favorite physical or digital products right now? You can kind of just ramble a little bit on that one.
Yeah. So, okay. Favorite physical product right now has to be my sauna. And these don't have to be crazy expensive. And I know it sounds crazy, the idea of having a sauna at your house. They have these little ones you can get on Amazon that are $150, $200 that kind of wrap around your body as well.
What?
They have like little infrared heaters built in. And
it's called a sweater.
Yeah, it's called a sweater. It's not a sweater. But I would say that the sauna has been really life-changing for me. It improves sleep quite a bit. You just feel better. It's a great non-alcohol, non-substance way to just kind of like really decompress. A sauna has done a lot. And there's a lot of great research has come out on the biohacking side from heat exposure and the release of something called heat shock proteins that result in more flexible blood vessels and lesser rates of certain types of cancers and stroke and cardiovascular issues and things like that. So,
many different cultures have something like a sauna in them that developed like independently all over the world.
Yes, absolutely.
It's huge here. Huge.
It's a fun culture to get involved in. If you don't have one or the means to get one at home, I was like, when I lived in San Francisco, there was no way I was putting one in my apartment. So I was going down to the local kind of, you can find these little banyas or these little traditional Russian or Turkish bathhouses that have great saunas. So
great. So that's physical. Any digital things tickling your fancy at the moment?
You know, I've been trying to use technology less. Hat tip to Jake there.
Did you uninstall Instagram?
No, I didn't. No. Not yet.
Don't be silly.
That's next. But I would say that digital items...
You can do another physical if you want.
Well, I'm trying to think about... I have nerdy stuff, man. Like, I just bought a UVB light that allows you to get natural B vitamins from ultraviolet UVB rays versus taking a supplemental B vitamin.
So that's how geeky and stupid I get on the kind of biohacking stuff. I like the Oura Ring for sleep tracking. Yeah. I think that's the best sleep tracker out there. That's a digital physical product.
Yeah.
Where do you put a light bulb so that you're around it enough that you absorb vitamins from it?
So here's the thing. I bought this on Amazon. It's a light that essentially, and I'll give you a link to it if you want to put in the show notes, but it just puts off UVB radiation, which is the type that does not, UVBA is the one that's associated with increased cancer rates. All this does is it doesn't even brown the skin. It just creates more vitamin D. And so you just have to do about 5 minutes a day. I'm doing it every other day to see what it does. So I'll get my blood drawn after a few weeks. And then you could just naturally see the increase of vitamin D in your body.
So you could put it on like a headlamp and just walk around, do your normal activities.
Well, this is like a device that has like, they almost look like tanning tubes. So they're very specific tubes. Yeah. It's not like just like a, there's some of those sad lights that you can get, the seasonal affective disorder. And those are just really bright white light, but that's not actually putting out UVB. So this is a different, more kind of clinical grade type device.
Okay, so in summary, tanning bed was Kevin's answer.
Sauna and tanning bed. So listen, everybody who's all the product designers listening to the Product Breakfast Club, get yourself a sauna and a tanning bed. And,
No. I just opened my iPhone so I can look. I got a couple more things to recommend. So I'll do Daily Art is an app on Android and on iOS that I love. So Daily Art, all it does is it shows you one full screen art image of a famous painting. Tells you about the artist, when it was originally created, what their place is in the art world in general, why they're relevant and important. And then you can favorite and save like your favorite artists or paintings. And it's just one new piece of art every single day.
That's really nice.
And it's fun. It's just like a really simple thing to learn a little bit more about art and culture. I love it. Just Daily Art is my favorite little app there.
How are they going to monetize that one?
They have like a unlock all the functionality for like a dollar or something. It's all no right, like recurring revenue thing or anything like that.
All right, cool. Anything else?
I say that Vivino is my favorite scanning of wine bottles and getting recommendations for wine.
Oh, yeah.
That's been out for a long time, but I think that's a fun little thing if you get into kind of trying different wines and things like that. It's been fun for me. But yeah, I'm trying to get rid of apps, to be honest. Like just doing a little bit less and spending less time on the phone has been a big focus of mine.
And that's why you're making more apps, just to give other people the feeling that they have to get rid of more things. Do you like to...
if anything, hopefully my meditation app is convincing people to use technology less. So.
Yeah, for sure. What are your current favorite sort of like, you know, health or life hacks that you can actually feel, like that you can feel the difference from? And I guess sauna is one of those things, but is there anything else?
Well, on the opposite of that, certainly the Wim Hof method done by the Iceman Wim Hof. He's the man that holds the Guinness Book World Records, the longest time submerged under ice. And the benefits and just energy that you get from doing ice baths and exposure to the cold. And he does this great, I think it's a 10-week course where he slowly ramps you up, starts you off by taking like a 15-second cold shower, you know, and then eventually you're doing a minute, and then eventually you're doing 5 minutes, and then 10, and you, without a doubt, by week about six or so, the changes in just natural energy and clarity become very apparent. So that's something where you'll certainly notice the benefits. The mushrooms, cordyceps, are great for energy. You can get those in supplemental form. I do a lot of medicinal mushrooms. I think those are really healthy for you. I use something called Stamen 7, which is a blend of seven different mushrooms that I couldn't tell the last time I was sick. It's been years now.
You just take it as a pill?
Yeah, I just take two a day. And they're just like a blend of seven different just like mushrooms that have been like kind of dried out and condensed down into a little supplement. Mm. And it's something that I've been doing for a long time. And I know Tim Ferriss started doing it as well and has been loving it. So definitely kind of big in the biohacking community is this idea of these medicinal mushrooms, which have been great.
This is not part of Jonathan's rapid fire.
What mushrooms are you taking, Jake?
But so I'm curious how you decide where to spend your efforts, Kevin, because you've been successful enough and the world is your oyster. Sort of you could build probably any kind of product or spend your effort researching any kind of thing. How do you decide like it's worth spending my time on a meditation app? It's worth creating a podcast. How do you decide?
Well, I think that if you would have spoke to me about this 5 years ago, the answer would be very different. I think that I was And when I was in the middle of just really startup mode, like crazy startup, Kevin, back in the dig days, it was all about how can I squeeze as much time out of the day and just really, really focus on being very productive and over caffeinated and just crank. And I realize, which everyone will eventually realize, it just depends on your age and where you are in your career, but you realize that that's just not sustainable, that it's not a way to live, and yeah. It leads to burnout. And I remember getting heart palpitations for the first time and being like, oh, whoa,
wow.
It was in the middle of my dig days and like feeling my heart skip a beat and having to go to the ER and have that checked out and make sure it wasn't anything serious. And just like all of a sudden your body just can't take it. And you hit this point where you realize that balance is so very important. And it's not just a fun little buzzword that people are throwing around these days, but stress will literally kill you. So just figuring out ways to live a more balanced life has been something that's been a passion of mine for like the last 5 or so years. And so when I have these folks on my podcast, I'm always just really curious as to their tactics. And I think it's the reason why Tim Ferriss and I did a show and we became good friends is that we were also both just bouncing around different little things that we were trying and reading about in terms of how can we find and strike a balance between being a very productive person that gets things done, that has a professional life, but also at the same time, being able to have downtime and being comfortable with things like being bored and actually not thinking of things like being bored as being a bad thing. So that's the reason I enjoy doing these podcasts is I get these little nuggets of information out of these people that have figured some of the stuff out and apply it to my own life and just see what sticks and what works. So I like trying out new things. I think that's part of the reason why I love startups and creators in general is like I am drawn to new ideas and new ways of thinking. And I like this idea of lifelong learning. I think it's how we continue to evolve and improve over time. And I want to make sure to embrace that always.
Actually, can I just ask you straight out for a piece of advice, Kevin? Like, and it's not a joke, believe me.
Is it about babies?
No, well, maybe. Well, here's the thing, right? I'm 30, just had my first kid, just took over my business. We just had like a bit of a buyout procedure. And we're sort of on this like path where revenue is doubling every year. It's going really, really good. I'm working really, really hard. You just talked about you're trying to find balance now. You've been over the last 5 years looking for this balance. I always worry that if I try to get comfortable or seek comfort, you know, at this point in my life, that whenever I do get comfort or whenever I do find a point in my life where I'm like, oh, you know what? I nailed it now. I don't need to do anything anymore. I could just keep doing this. I often start to feel a little bit lost or unhappy, actually. Do you kind of get what I mean? Like when it starts to slow down a little bit?
Yeah, I think that there's the ego saying, I need to be relevant. I need to go and create something again, be big, get my name in the press. There's like that kind of drive that can be associated with some of that stuff every once in a while. And it leads to a lot of people not being able to slow down, like to be always have to be like, okay, I got to chase this because I've done so well and I'm doubling my business. I got to double it again, you know? And so I'm saying that because I know that's where I've been. I'm not saying that's where you are, but that's certainly where I've been is this yearning for more success and feeling like if I take my foot off the gas, like, holy shit, like I could just be irrelevant, you know? And so I think that my recommendation there would be don't change anything, but do find time to have a moment where you can say, this is my time to take my foot off the gas.
Right.
It doesn't mean that I change my day-to-day work. It doesn't mean I work less hours. It doesn't mean anything else other than just set aside some time initially to say, I'm going to have this downtime. Could be 15 minutes, could be 30 minutes, ideally around 30 minutes. Might include a little bit of a meditation practice.
Maybe an app.
Yeah, would you say maybe an app?
Maybe an app.
Perhaps an app or two. But really just like saying like, okay, because I think that you can feel the importance of having that balance and having and needing some of that downtime.
Yes.
But you need to give yourself, you don't want to change too many things overnight, right? So I think just starting off with a small little chunk of time that you can call your own and not feel guilty about. You know, like so many times, so many people, they say, I don't have time to meditate. When I do meditate, I'm constantly thinking about work.
Yeah.
And I just can't get out of my own head, blah, blah, blah. And it's like, consider just framing to yourself and telling yourself, even if I don't meditate well during this time, this is my time. I get to own it. And I'm okay with this not going well in terms of meditating, but I'm not going to get up and go back to the office. And once you do that enough times, then you can finally start to relax and enjoy that little window. And hopefully that window will start to creep into everyday life and finding other little moments that you can just pause and take a deep breath, but really do it in a meaningful way, not just like a way that you're doing it because you read or you heard it was good, but really like letting go a little bit, you know?
Yeah, I think that's really great advice, because it is one of those things where you, like you said, you do have this worry about taking your foot off the gas. And I almost feel like at this point in my life, I don't want to. I haven't gotten to the point yet where I want to take my foot off the gas, but I also see the danger of it just being this nonstop, like hardcore thing, and then realizing it 5 years from now and being like, oh, holy shit, now I have to take more drastic measures.
Yeah, well, that and just on also understanding that if you're really building a durable, lasting business, this isn't about sprinting. Like, you're never going to win.
So true.
You really have to like think of this as like something you're going to build over the next 10, 15, 20 years.
Yeah. Yeah.
And in that case, don't run. Like, just be thoughtful, execute. But it means you are working and you are being very productive, but knowing when to turn off and step away. You had Jason Fried on your podcast.
For sure.
I love his idea of just saying, don't let work creep into your own personal time into the night, and don't answer emails on the weekends. Like,
yeah,
it's so healthy for the body.
Yeah. It's easier said than done, but I 100% agree with it. I mean, Jason Fried is like, you know, every time I read his stuff or read his tweets, I'm like, oh, God damn it. I forgot to get my, you know, monthly dose of Jason Fried just so I can, you know, chill and stop checking my emails over the weekend. But yeah.
Yeah. It's really frustrating listening to Jason, because you're just like, stop being so cool. Like, you're just saying all the right things, and you almost don't want your employees to read his stuff.
Exactly. Fuck off, Jason. Yeah. Your Fridays off in the summer, you piece of shit.
Yeah.
I do love Jason, by the way, but, and I'm sure he listened to that exact part. Well, guys, I think that was a lovely hour. And even though, Kevin, I'm sure myself and Jake would love to ask you questions for another 4 hours, I'm sure.
I have questions for both you guys.
Yeah, go ahead.
One last question. I want to know, what is something that you believe to be true today that you didn't 5 years ago?
You go first, Jake.
Wow. Sorry, we're out of time, Kevin.
Goodbye, everybody.
Man, I don't know if it's true for everybody, but it's certainly true for me. And this will be like probably pretty obvious to you, because you've spent most or all of your career working for yourself. But I haven't realized before the last couple of years how important it is to experience in life, maybe not your whole life, but at least for a while, working for yourself, starting something that's just you, and not having a company around you that, you know, so that you're reliant on them, just as we were talking about, you know, checking email on the weekends and structures that are in place. It's so important to try to figure that stuff out for yourself. And now, as a parent, I'm thinking, how do I encourage my kids to have those experiences younger? Because once you start working for people, you get in a tunnel of doing
that. Yeah. That Google milk is so sweet, though.
So sweet. Oh, man. It's so sweet. Yeah. <That's good. laughs> Yeah. What about you, John?
Actually, I'm going to cheat, because I sort of brought this up a few episodes ago, and actually I already mentioned it in this podcast, and it goes against every piece of advice Kevin just told me. One of the things that I know now that I didn't really know 5 years ago is that for me, seeking comfort is not a path to happiness at all. About 5 years ago, I think the company was in a place where, yeah, technically I could have had a lifestyle business a la Tim Ferriss style, you know, travel the world, kind of money is being made in the background somehow, and I don't need to work anymore. But I realized that this is just something that I don't want. And what I want is to grow something. And what I want to be is to be a part of something that is bigger than me. So I think for me, what I know now, what I didn't know then, and this also applies to me having a kid. I really didn't want to have a kid 5 years ago, because I just didn't want any inconveniences in my life, anything that could add discomfort. And really today, I have a very different feeling for that. I almost actively look for things that could add more layers of not necessarily discomfort, but challenge to my life. I really kind of embrace it rather than kind of push it away. So I think for me, what I know now that I didn't know 5 years ago is that actually a good balance between discomfort and, I don't want it to be chaotic, but controlled discomfort is something that I need in my life.
That's awesome. It's always good to be a little uncomfortable. It means you're growing.
Yeah, well, you know, depends on what sort of uncomfortable we're talking about here. I'm wearing some pretty uncomfortably tight underwear right now. And I think that's a great way to end the podcast. I wanted to end it on something really crap, you know, after all those really great answers, just like something really useless.
I'm not going to let you end it on that one. Just the last thing to put a cherry on top, which is
Jake.
What you just said, John, it's not actually incompatible with the idea of creating space. Like,
right.
You can create space, headspace. Mental space.
Like the app Headspace you're talking about, right?
The app Oak. You'd want to use Oak.
Exactly.
Thank you, Jay. Appreciate that.
You can create that space without stopping the building, the effort, the chaos, the struggle. And actually, you know, you talked about it as like a Tim Ferriss like lifestyle business, or like, let's look at our friend Kevin and like what he's doing. Yeah. He's still striving and struggling and building new things and like growing. But I think the challenge is finding space while doing that.
Yeah.
And the end result, like the goal shouldn't be taking your foot off the gas and just resting, but finding rest within the struggle.
Love that. Way better ending than the underwear thing.
Download Oak right now. Download Oak.
Yeah. Nice. Kevin, what can our huge, unimaginably large audience do for you?
Gosh, I would say if you just want to keep up with my crazy adventures, the best place is just Instagram, Kevin Rose on there, and just follow me up there and you'll see my new podcasts and all that good stuff. And you can decide what you want to consume or not or whatever.
Great. Dude, thanks so much for taking the time out to come on the Product Breakfast Club. I think it was really one of the best episodes ever.
Can I get an exit song?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. We do sing it out. Yeah, that's true. We'll sing it out.
I'm not going to sing, but I would.
You have to sing.
You just want to hear it? Okay. You can hear it live.
Okay. Let's do it. But Jason, here's what's going to happen. All right. We're going to do the exit song, but then Kevin's going to go, but then we're probably going to continue talking for a bit, but don't leave yet.
Okay.
All right.
Product Breakfast Club. Product Breakfast Club. Ooh, yeah, baby.
That was a great interview session with Kevin Rose.
Okay, I think.
Is he gone?
I think he's gone.
Okay.
Yeah, I think he's gone. Okay. Shh. Hey, everybody, listen up. We have a little bit of a favor to ask you. So, first, we're assuming and hoping that Kevin won't listen back to this episode.
There's almost no chance that he will. So, I think we're clear.
Yeah, because, you know, it's the Product Breakfast Club. And so, here's what I'm going to ask you, like a favor, because what we need to do is we need to get to 10,000 listeners. If we do not get to 10,000 listeners by the end of February, we're going to cancel the Product Breakfast Club, and I'm going to have to give Jake $30, which is not going to be great. So anybody who cares about the existence of the Product Breakfast Club, help us out with this one thing. All we want you to do is post about how much you loved this episode and how great, well, obviously only if you think it, but I think you will think it, and how great it was to listen to Kevin on this thing. Post that on Twitter, post that on Instagram, tag Kevin Rose, and here's what's going to happen. Here's what's going to happen. If you do that, he might retweet it. And if he retweets it, more people will listen to the podcast. That's the whole thing. That's the whole scheme.
That's the whole thing. Okay. All right. We get a bunch of listeners who were like following Kevin Rose. They'll hate this podcast. Churn. It's going to be a recipe for churn. So yeah, do it if you want. I still think my bet is safe. I don't think we have a chance of getting to 10,000.
10,000. Jake, 10, you saw we are at 8,500 now, motherfucker.
8,700. It's really getting close. It's getting very close. And that wasn't even after the full 6 weeks. So yeah. Okay. I know it's tough. This could actually push us over. Don't do it. I want to win the bet.
Da, 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 da. Oh, Jason, will you also put in the exciting, the dramatic music when I talk about, you know. All right, everybody. Thanks so much for listening to the Product Breakfast Club. I hope you enjoyed this very one-off guest episode. Don't expect anything like this ever again.
Don't expect good guests anymore.
Don't expect guests in general or good episodes. Except 2 episodes ago, Jake, right? 2 episodes ago, we talked about this Connie Chan thing.
That was a good one.
We talked about China. If you want to listen to the good episode of Product Breakfast Club, that was the one.
And this one. This was a good one.
And this is the second one.
It's pretty good. We're like 2 for 3, the last 3.
Yeah.
It's pretty good.
But last week's episode was a piece of shit, though. It was the worst episode ever.
Okay.
Bye, everybody.
Bye, everybody.
Product Breakfast Club. Product Breakfast Club.
Product Breakfast Club.
Product Breakfast Club.